welcome to the Lenny's Crazy Podcast. This is podcast number 69, and I've been doing just fine, thank you very much. Pulse Audio, I have it pretty much figured out for today. It's working today, fine. I went back to my M-Audio Podcast Factory sound card, and it seems to work a lot better with Pulse Audio than my Samson USB microphone for some reason. Not exactly sure. I think it's because there is a default file in the etc. Pulse directory that already has a configuration for one of these M-Audio Fast Track sound cards. It's basically a USB sound card, and it works really well. One of the big advantages of this particular sound card is that you can plug in a regular microphone to it, and you could plug in a guitar to it or anything like that. Plus, it has a mute button on it, so you can mute it if you want to. And it also seems to work very well with Ikeja. It's worked well with everything I've tried it on so far. A friend of Russ's wanted me to make sure that I mention, be sure and attend if you're close by or if you can make it there, to the inaugural Texas Linux Fest in Austin, Texas on April the 10th. They're getting everything together. I'll put a link on the website at linuxcrazy.com.
I'm Austin bound, get my feelings checked at the door.
That's right, Texas has its own community-run Linux Fest on April 10th, 2010 in Austin, Texas. Go to texaslinuxfest.org for details. And remember, get your Linux on.
I'm Austin bound, get my eyes set on the price.
Also, if you ever want to contact me, just send me an email. It's david@linuxcrazy.com. And also, please stop by IRC. It's the server Freenode, and the channel is #LinuxCrazy. I finished the book I was working on, Pro Bash Programming by Chris Johnson, and it seemed like I learned a little bit. My problem is it just seems like it takes so long for me to finally grasp this programming. I keep plugging away at it. I seem to get a little bit better and a little bit better along. A lot of times what helps me is to take what I've learned and try to incorporate it into a script that actually does something that I can kind of feel proud of so that it feels like that I'm accomplishing something. And a lot of times what I'll do is I'll go ahead and research first, and I don't really come up with the total program all by myself, to be perfectly honest. What I'll do is sometimes I'll take one program and kind of modify it for my needs, or I'll take a couple different programs and modify it for my needs. But along the way, I do learn. What I did was I wanted to send a email each day to my buddies, like a thought of the day. And the site that I go to is at Hazleton. So the actual web page is a big web page. So I had to come up with a little script to pull out the information that I wanted to send in an email to my buddies. So basically what I do is I used links to dump the URL that I have, and then I used tail to strip off the first part of the page. Then I used head to strip off the bottom part of the page, because the part, the little thought for today that I wanted was basically in the middle of the page. So once I stripped off the top and the bottom, I got the part that I wanted, and then I had to put it into a bash script in order to email it to my buddies. And the interesting thing about this is that it incorporates a couple other things that I had already set up, but has been working really good. Postfix is, I use Postfix here on my little local network at home. it works really well, and it actually will forward mail through my ISP. My ISP, as so far, everything has been working really good. I keep all I have is DSL, but I have a whole bunch of stuff here. I've got my Asterix, and I've got a little web server, and it's not a big traffic. Nothing is really a big traffic. It's mainly just stuff for me to kind of learn and use. Like on my web server, there's no big downloads or anything. I keep the bandwidth to a minimum. I'm not doing any kind of spamming with email or anything. You know, everything's legitimate. So I set PostFix up, and it's pretty neat. I'll put all these files up on the linuxcrazy.com. I'm not going to go through every little detail on them, but PostFix works really well as far as relaying mail through your ISP. So all I have to do is PostFix has a symbolic link to like send mail. So the script is basically just sending it through user sbin send mail, but it's actually not send mail. It's actually PostFix that's actually sending the mail. Another thing I've been working on is working in the Gentoo Bugzilla. I've talked about this before on the podcast, and it gives me a lot of enjoyment because I can actually see myself progressing and fixing a few more bugs. I've actually gotten better at patching, like make files and patching different files. And the one area that I'm helping out is the Perl herd, because there's nobody really active in the Perl herd at Gentoo. Tove has been, he's a longtime Gentoo developer. He's kind of been taking care of the Perl herd because it pretty much has been abandoned, which is a shame. There's a couple people that are proficient Perl programmers that are now in the process of becoming full-fledged developers, and I hope some of them make it as far as to be developers, because Perl needs someone that's really a Perl programmer to be involved. You know, I'm basically just I guess you would call me as a grunt, is that I can just do some simple fixes and this and that, but I can't really do any major Perl work because I'm not a Perl programmer. What I have been able to do is just do research on the internet with Google, basically, and search down and find fixes for some of these programs that are failing to either install or they're failing to produce the required documentation, or they're failing when they run their tests. So I'll search this out and find out which ones that I can fix, and then I'll go ahead and create a patch, update the e-build, and test it. And once it's all working good, then I go to Bugzilla and I post my fix, and everybody seems to be pretty happy. Me especially, because I like the gratification of being able to actually fix something. Tove, the gentleman that's been mentoring me as far as this fixing these bug reports, and also he's mentoring me to become a full-time developer, which is still in the, I guess, holding period, I guess you'd say. I haven't really heard anything about it. I'm not really in a big rush. It doesn't really matter. I just wanted to help out. It would be nice. I don't know. I could actually commit some of these fixes myself, and it would save time so that somebody else wouldn't have to do it. I feel comfortable enough fixing the simple ones that I run across. And if it's something more involved, then I'll just ask somebody. That's all. I have access to the Gentoo website, and I've been fixing different web pages, adding information to the site and everything. So I've gotten pretty comfortable with how that works. And Tove is I don't know his full background, but he's definitely a Bash programmer. And what's really interesting about these e-builds is these e-builds have things that are called e-classes. And I kind of know pretty much what a class is. It's from when I was doing the Python. Basically, what you can do is you can inherit these classes. So you would inherit, if you're going to install a Perl module, then you would use inherit Perl module e-class. and it's pretty cool. Now, the actual Perl module E-class actually inherits from a couple other E-classes. It actually inherits from E-utilities and base. So what that entails is that when you do the E-builds, as long as you know the E-classes, it can save you a lot of time and effort, because the certain functions that need to be run over and over again are already covered in the E-classes. So your E-build actually doesn't have to have much information in it. In fact, if you inherit from the Perl module E-class, and it's a pretty simple module, you really only have to enter just a few lines of code in the E-build, and the E-classes takes care of all the other work for you. So that's pretty cool stuff. You just have to do a little research. That's what I've been doing, is in studying these E-classes so that I kind of understand how everything works together. And it's just like anything else, it just takes time. You have to spend some time doing it. That's why I feel it's very important to try to keep the developers that you have, the Gen 2 developers, on board, even if they're not doing a whole lot of work, just maintaining a few packages, because they've already gone through this initial learning process. It's a lot easier to do it once you've been doing it for a little while, instead of having to constantly train new people. Now, it's always, the more the merrier. Training new people is always good. It's just, it's such a long, involved process with Gen 2 to become a full-fledged developer. First, even though if you want to become a full-fledged developer, you have to have some kind of talent, and then you have to be recognized by the actual developers, because they don't want just anybody in the Portage tree. They want to kind of make sure that there's a little track record of trust built up ahead of time, so that when they go ahead and make a person a full-fledged developer, they know from past experience and time that they've spent with the person that they're basically going to do the right thing. Yeah, like I said, I finished that book, Pro Bash Programming, and now I'm back to the book that I started, that I stopped because it was going into regular expressions, and I wanted to learn and study a little bit more on the straight bash before I kept going. So here I am. I'm now on page 374 of Linux Command Line and Shell Scripting Bible. And this is by Richard Blum. This is a very good book, and it's got a whole bunch of different stuff in it. And now I'm on the part about regular expressions. Now, I've studied some regular expressions before, and it's one of those things that it's a never-ending learning process. I've kind of gotten the basics of it now, and what I do is I just keep practicing over and over again. I have like three different directories in my home directory. I have Bash practice, I have Perl Python practice, and I also have sed and awk and grep. So I have five different folders that I actually CD into, and then I'll test little scripts and stuff to see how I'm doing. So it just takes a lot of time and effort, and little by little, I'm getting a little bit better. Yeah, my goal in all of this is to become halfway proficient with Bash so that I can basically do these e-builds feeling comfortable with editing them and so forth, because they're all basically Bash scripts, sophisticated Bash scripts. So once I get that done, I want to go back to Python. Python's a lot of fun to play around with. And so I want to go back to Core Python Programming by Wesley Chun. I want to do that whole book from the start to the end, and also do the exercises. So if there's anybody out there that really wants to be serious about going through a Python book, that's going to take a while. It'll take, if anybody wants to do it with me, it'll probably take us a year you know, 6 months anyhow to go through it all, but it'd be a lot of fun. And I can provide a lot of resources. I can provide a wiki that we can go to. I can provide a forum, stuff like that. But it would be a big help to me if there was anyone interested in going through the book with me. I went through it one time, but I kind of just, I didn't really go through it really, you know, thorough. I want to really go through it really thorough. So if you're interested, please just send me an email at david@linuxcrazy.com. And it's not that big a deal. We're not going to rush through it, so we could just do a little along, you know. Let's see. What else has I been up to? I've been keeping up with the Pulse Audio because I know in the future that there's going to be a lot of people having questions about Pulse Audio. And it's one of the things that I can kind of do a little research now. And hopefully I'll be able to help some people out. And I subscribe to the Pulse Audio mailing list and also check the Pulse Audio IRC channel. And one of the very knowledgeable gentlemen that is part of Pulse Audio, he actually is part of Pulse Audio for Mandriva. And his name is Colin Guthrie. And if you follow his posts on the mailing list, you can tell that he's a very knowledgeable person and he seems like a genuinely pretty nice fellow. I'm going to send him an email and try to see if I can set up an interview with him. But in the meantime, he explains Pulse Audio and ALSA very well. And I followed his well, how he talks about this on the mailing list and also on his website. So I'm going to kind of steal his explanation and go ahead and kind of explain it a little bit as I'm starting to understand it myself. Sound on Linux is very confusing, and you know we hear that a lot. It's also very confusing to me. And also, especially, it's getting real confusing now with the addition of Pulse Audio. So, you know, we always hear that, and that sound is confusing on Linux. And while I don't disagree with the statement, as with everything on Linux, the sound system is pretty logical. And if you follow through the steps, you can demystify things pretty quickly. So the article that Colin talks about here kind of explains how to demystify the ALSA and Pulse Audio. First of all, we should probably explain a little bit about how this works. ALSA is the Advanced Linux Sound Architecture. It is a replacement for OSS, Open Sound System, that had several problems on Linux and which has ultimately been supplemented by ALSA as the only sound system in the kernel, despite a relaxation of license terms and further development on OSS version 4. OSS is unlikely to replace ALSA in the mainline kernel. ALSA also has a user space component, libasound, that acts as a primary interface to the driver layer. Most complaints about the complexity of the ALSA API actually relate to this user space component, not the kernel layer, which, as you'd expect, is much more rigorously controlled. It does not suffer from the same need to remain backwards compatible with various user space applications. The ALSA kernel drivers only need to work with libasound, which can obviously be developed in parallel, thus leading to a cleaner design than the user space layer itself, which does have to remain backward compatible. In addition to interfacing with the kernel layer and interacting with sound hardware physically installed, ALSA also has a plug-in architecture. This plug-in system allows for devices to be faked, emulated in various interesting ways. It allows, for example, to create a null device that sends all audio to device null. It allows for Bluetooth headsets to be used. Note, this is considered a legacy way these days, and it allows all audio to be routed through Pulse Audio, which I'll discuss later on. So let's talk about ALSA configuration files. Now, most of the ALSA configuration files live in user share ALSA. Arguably, these are not really config files in the classic sense, i.e., you are not meant to change them as a user according to own preferences and whims. They are really more like source files and define the structure of various ALSA plugins and multi-channel configurations. Unless you are developing hacking on ALSA, you probably shouldn't tweak the vast majority of the files in this folder. The main file is in user share ALSA ALSA config on most distributions. It defines a list of additional files to parse and the order in which to parse them. In order to incorporate Pulse Audio in an elegant and configurable way, they make a couple changes to the list of additional files. Basically, what they'll add in there is they add etc. ALSA pulse default config. They also add user share ALSA PCM pulse audio dot config. The first file, the pulse audio dot config, defines a name device for ALSA called pulse. This is always present even if their user ultimately decides not to use pulse audio by default on their machine. This would allow them to define a remote Pulse Audio server, and also it tells ALSA apps to use this device specifically. Arguably, this is a corner case, but there is no reason not to support all this at the same time. I'm not exactly sure how that all works. I guess you can have one centralized sound server. The second file, the ALSA Pulse Default Config, allows you to turn on Pulse Audio by default. This is pretty important, as offering users a simple way to enable, disable Pulse Audio is highly desirable. Pulse Audio rollout has not been completely free from problems, as we all know, and giving some users the ability to quickly and easily disable it is essential. Colin writes here that he firmly believes that everyone will ultimately use Pulse Audio, and I also do too. Here on the machine that I have here, it's getting better and better. In fact, I really don't have too many problems with Pulse Audio currently, but I've pretty much tweaked my installation because I've started to understand exactly what everything does a little by little. It's way more complicated than ALSA used to be. I used to just have to run ALSA config, go ahead and make sure that the mixer was, the settings were unmixed, and that was pretty much it. Now, I did have problems when I wanted to play two or three different streams at the same time. The sound wouldn't work, or I would have to make sure that I was only doing one thing at a time. Pulse Audio is very well with that. I can have Flash playing, I can play an MP3 file, and I can work in Audacity. In fact, Audacity has started to get a lot better too. I still don't try to do too many things at once though. When I'm doing with Audacity, because I think the code is a legacy code and it's not really designed to work with Pulse Audio quite yet, Audacity is actually used by a lot of people on Windows machines. So I guess to be able to be, and also, I guess, Macs, too. So it's not really a all-in-all Linux-only program. And to the same extent, the little bit I've been reading about Pulse Audio is that Pulse Audio is going to be able to be run on any operating system also. So we'll see. But I can report that I have now, when I use Audacity, with just Audacity, it's been working very well for me, but I've gotten pretty used to how to configure it and all the different configuration files to edit and to change for my particular setup. I have started, instead of using modules so much or using UDEV and using, Hald to detect the sound devices, I'm getting more and more is that I am hard coding actual sound cards, and that seems to help me personally as far as making it a little bit more stable as far as I know what's going to happen if I open an application and go ahead and try to play it, as long as my hardware stays the same. The problem with that is that the reason that you need Howled Damien to load this stuff is because on different machines you're not exactly positive of what hardware everyone has. Once you've got Pulse Audio and ALSA on your system, and you know that you're going to be using that same sound card, you don't need to have Hauled enabled as far as Pulse Audio is concerned. I don't think, but I'm no expert, but I don't think it seems to work better when I just go ahead and hard code my sound cards in there. Right now I'm only using two. I use an old Sound Blaster card for actual just playing music and playing sound, and then I'm using this M-Audio here. Is all I use it for is just recording off the microphone like I'm doing now. So back to Colin's little explanation of Pulse Audio and ALSA. The file we were talking about was Pulse default.config. So when an ALSA application starts up, it parses all of these files and ultimately works out how to route your audio 99% of the time. The default device is used, and when we say default device, it's in the loosest possible sense. For a standard install, the default device is actually Pulse Audio via the Pulse Audio plugin for ALSA on most newer installations. So what happens next is an application using the ALSA API tries to open the default device, assuming we've configured this device as the default to be the Pulse Audio plugin for ALSA. It will basically act like every Pulse Audio client application. We're now into the land of the Pulse Audio configuration. The Pulse Audio client, Pulse Audio adopts a client server model that is very similar in principle to that of the X11 system. It is the server that actually outputs the audio and the client app that tells the server what to play. While this approach can be inefficient, resulting in the copying of auto data around, Pulse Audio goes to great lengths to ensure that data copying and other latency-prone operations are kept to a minimum. In the common use case of both client and server running on the same machine, Pulse Audio uses shared memory to ensure that data sent from client to server is not copied across the wire. The core of the Pulse Audio server itself is zero copy, meaning that references to the data are passed around without actually copying the data itself. The first thing a Pulse Audio client has to do is to connect to the server. In order to do this, it checks various variables and configuration files to determine precisely to which server it will connect. Initially, the Pulse Audio client library looks for a Pulse Server environment variable. If found, this variable can define a list of servers to which the client should connect. These servers can be specified as local Unix sockets or DNS names, IP addresses for a TCP connection. If this variable does not exist or is empty, Pulse Audio will then check for X11 properties on the root window. These properties are much like environmental variables, but will be available remotely if you SSH to another machine with X11 forwarding. The variable names used are the same as those used in the environment, so Pulse Audio will look for a property called Pulse Server. Assuming it still has not got an answer to a server to connect to yet, Pulse Audio will check for default server configuration in its client config file. This file is located in usually an etc. pulse or your home folder .pulse. Only one of the client config files is parsed, so if the user has their own one, the system will not be parsed at all. So it just depends which file you have. So on my system, I just keep it etc. pulse. So now we've tried three ways to find a server. If we still have not found one, we just resort to defaults, connecting to the local personal Damien and a local system-wide Damien. System-wide use is generally not recommended, but it is supported for certain circumstances. Basically, for a regular user, though, you want to use the user Damien to connect to Pulse Audio. If we still cannot connect, the client config file can specify whether or not we will try to automatically start a personal Damien. Since Pulse Audio 0.9.11, this is the default behavior and allows console applications to work out of the box without starting a Pulse Audio Damien beforehand. So in the unlikely event that all this fails, we would ultimately not be able to play sound. But we've done pretty much everything we can to make it work. In order to better visualize this, let's look at a couple of typical Serenos and run through the above process. Console application. So under a default install, we've booted to run level 3 and logged into the terminal. We don't set any special variables and start an application that plays sound via ALSA. Here's what happens. Apt opens default device. ALSA Pulse Audio plugin, like any Pulse Audio client, checks its config for a server and finds none. It tries to connect to a local server, but fails as it is not running. So then starts a Pulse Audio server automatically and then connects to it. The application then plays audio via the ALSA API functions, and this is ultimately played by the Pulse Audio Damien. The client application finishes doing its thing and exits. The Pulse Audio Damien stays around for a while just in case another app wants to play sound in the near future. After a while, the Pulse Audio Damien will go in the huff because no one is really wants it anymore, and it goes ahead and eventually kills itself. So that's it pretty simply. All right, let's have another application. X11 application. Under X11, things are a little bit different, but the same basic principles were followed. When X11 starts, modern desktops that support XDG auto start ultimately run the script start pulse audio -X11. This script ensures the Pulse Audio Damien is started and some extra X11 related modules loaded into it. These modules ensure that, unlike a console application, the X11 Pulse Audio Damien will not exit after an idle timeout. It will instead stick around for as long as the X11 session exists. This ensures that the X11 properties mentioned earlier are set. The reasons for this will become apparent in the next example. When any Pulse Audio client, be it an ALSA app via the ALSA Pulse Audio plugin or a native Pulse Audio, is started, it goes through its find a server routine. It will now stop this process when it reaches the X11 properties and use the info there and connect to the server. The client application then plays sound as before and ultimately finishes an exit. The Pulse Audio Damien doesn't kill exit after this. It just stays going. So again, things are actually quite simple. A remote X11 application. One of the handiest things with X11 is the ability to connect to another machine on your network and run GUI applications and have them displayed on your local display. With Pulse Audio, the sound is also heard on the local machine. Out of the box, for security reasons, remote connections are not enabled. To enable them, you run PAPREFS, that's PA Press, and enable the option Enable Network Access to Local Sound Devices. This is the only option needed for this example. It loads an additional module into the server that listens on TCP port 4713 for incoming connections. Obviously, it goes without saying that any firewall on the machine must allow connections to this port. So here's what happens. User starts a normal X11 session, and the start Pulse Audio X11 script ensures the X11 properties are set as in the previous example. User then connects to another machine on his network via SSH and starts an audio player. Even though the app is running remotely, the visual display will be local. When the app starts playing audio, the Pulse Audio client portion will find the X11 properties that have been forwarded through the SSH connection. The Pulse Audio client will then connect over TCP to the Pulse Audio server running on the local machine. The user revels in the local display and audio the application provides. So as you can see, the use of the X11 properties has allowed us to piggyback on top of the X11 forwarding. It's not a totally clean connection, as under SSH, the X11 data will actually be tunneled over a secure link handled by SSH itself, whereas all we are doing is telling the Pulse Audio client where to connect directly outside of any SSH tunnels. This means that while the display can work over a NATed session, the sound will not. This is fairly easily addressed, but we'd have to teach SSH about Pulse Audio for this to work. The reason it works for X11 is because SSH is aware of and has specific support for X11. We're just piggybacking on top of this. That said, the current arrangement is good enough for most use cases. All right, well, that gives you the basic background and understanding of how ALSA and Pulse Audio works together. Well, I'm starting to get kind of itchy to get back to Bugzilla and see if I can't track down an easy bug to fix. So I'll talk to you all later. And if you have any suggestions for a podcast or if you would like for me to talk about something, just go ahead and send me an email at david@linuxcrazy.com. I've been getting a few emails along from people that have been supportive, and that really helps me stay motivated to keep putting the podcast out. I'm going to try to work on a couple interviews. The interviews are actually a little bit easier for me than doing a regular, just a straight podcast. But I enjoy them both, and we'll keep it up. So sure hope everyone has a great new year, and I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.